tell you things about. I recognize the name, but I could not say a single thing about it.
Yeah, it's mostly nursing. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay,
Yeah.
That's nice.
But yeah, you clocked me.
Yeah,
You got
this is
me.
the right thing.
Do you think you're gonna stay in Boston?
No. No.
Oh, here's Gil.
But no, we're
Oh, look at that.
moving back to Minneapolis.
Yeah.
You drive or fly?
I fly for Brits, but I drive for the itself.
I get on.
Yeah, so I will be
Fly
driving.
again.
Let's see.
He's a very good traveler.
Airplane.
He tucks himself under the seat and thinks very small thoughts. I was thinking about glasses.
Jeff, are you? Oh, you are good. Okay, we'll wait just 1 minute.
She's small. I mean, if
be aware that we're recording, which we do with this class anyhow each time. Okay, we can start. So my class that is this is high class, Jeff.
Hi, everybody. I've seen a lot. I've listened to you all a lot. I feel like I know you. So see you all. Yeah, I've been loving this class.
Okay, so you've heard a little bit about Jeff. I'll just say a little bit more. He's a professor of English at Princeton. He's written a bunch of books, a really cool book called The Afterlife of Property, Domestic Security in the Victorian Novel, which unfortunately has a chapter on Silas Marner in it. That's looking for. And two books on Oscar Wilde, who we'll be talking about a bit today. And a book called Notebook, which is a kind of series of amazing, striking, aphoristic, observations about things, which the New Yorker had an article on, but it's much better than New Yorker. He's finishing a book called Walt and Joyce, which is not Walt Whitman and James Joyce, but a book about his parents. So its full title right now, right, Jeff, is Walt and Joyce, A Political History.
I think something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's about, to quote Shelley, how they met, why they parted, what it had to do. That's the Shelley part, how they met, why they parted, unquote. What it had to do, how it had to do with political history in the United States from around the time of Pearl Harbor to around, would you say the 1970s or all the way through?
Well, it's loosely sort of from the tail end of the Truman administration through Carter's administration. So it's basically a book about what it was like to be raised by mixed race parents for whom the mixed racedness was itself a kind of political position or move. It was bringing integration home, and it was a moment of kind of an identity based on transcending particular identity. It was, you know, old school liberalism.
So and how it worked, and how much work it was.
Yeah, exactly.
And what kind of ways that it succeeded, what kinds of ways that it was put under stress, let's say. Okay, anyhow, as I say, Jeff has two books on Wilde, each better than the other, and which is actually true. And he's a wonderful writer and teacher and thinker, and we've team taught before. So so we're doing something of that sort now, I suppose. But and these are the students.
I would love for people to introduce themselves, because I feel that I know you, but I want to actually put how do I put this, faces to the voice, so people could just
okay,
I know you. Yeah, so if I could just
ask to the
hi
voice.
Yeah,
okay, so why don't we just go counterclockwise?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Quinn.
I'm Red.
Hey, Red. Good to meet you.
Okay. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Sophia.
Hi, Sophia.
Hi, I'm Aileen.
Aileen, yeah.
I'm Sam.
Hey, Sam.
Oh, I'm Samantha.
Hey, Samantha.
I'm Julia.
Julia, nice to meet you.
I'm Leon. Nice to meet you.
Leon. Could you say your name again one more time?
Leon. Yeah.
Leon, good to meet you.
Nice to meet you, yeah.
Hi, I'm Irina.
Hi, Irina. Jeff, yeah, yeah. So Billy, I just wanted to say one thing before we really kind of dove in. First of all, I barely remember any of the things that I've written about Oscar Wilde. I barely remember them, although they're very important. I'm sure they're very brilliant. I just don't remember them. But what I mentioned right now is it's been wonderful listening to you all, to your class, and I mean your class. It's all of your class. It's been a real joy listening to it. It's interesting for me to approach Wilde in the way that we will be doing it in this class, as a poet and as a poet in the context of the Yeats and Kipling and of course Lionel Johnson. That's a more obvious connection. Well, Yeats is too, but to remember Wilde as a poet, because I don't think he's a particularly good poet. And I think, I don't know if Billy said as much to you, I can't remember now, but I would like to know what Wilde think. But just starting with that, and not just poetry, but also, you all read at least parts of Reading Jail, I gather, right? Did you or not?
Yes, yeah. We enthusiastically affirm your
sorry you all. So I guess I wanted to start by just asking your impressions of what you read for today. Anything at all about Reading Jail? Or to put it differently, what kind of person do you think? I mean, yes, any observations about Wilde? Or to put it differently, if you didn't know anything about Wilde's life, do you know about Wilde's life? I gather you do a little bit from what Billy did in class, and Wilde's rep, his reputation, and why his fall was so huge. Why it seemed to have mattered, you know, or what was involved. Wilde's destruction, we can put it that way. Wilde's conviction and his prison sentence, his humiliation, and I think it's fair to call it his public destruction. His demolition had huge effects on Edwardian, late Victorian, we'll call it that, England, so much so that for years after, the very name Wilde was a little bit like the name Hitler, that it was just not, it was not a name, it was, or Adolf, that would be better, it was just not a name, it was a name that was more or less erased for a long time. Wilde's own sons famously went by different last names, it was
the Rosenbergs,
right? Like Julius and Ethel, right? Exactly.
Well, like their sons, yeah.
The Mirapools, exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's a really interesting analogy, for more reason than one. And so this happened, and it's to such an extent that even you get lines like in references to Wilde in Forster's homosexual novel Maurice, where someone is referred to one of those unspeakable Oscar Wilde types, and that was as close as people could get to the mention of homosexuality. So he was really, but prior to that, one of the reasons why Wilde thought that he could get away with so much was that he was incredibly charming and witty, and he was never, it's a little bit, I hate to make these comparisons because it was all about his insistence on having it both ways and not being taken too seriously. And what happened was Carson and the people who prosecuted Wilde and eventually brought him down, took him very seriously, took him as it were, more or less literally. And that's one of the things that goes on in the story of Wilde. So by the time you get to the Ballad of Reading Jail, if you've read anything else by Wilde, anything at all, it will be a very different Oscar Wilde, whether it's the Wilde of even of Dorian Gray, but certainly of The Importance of Being Earnest. How many of you all have read The Importance of Being Earnest? So what's the play about? What's your impression of it?
It's trying to think of it.
But essentially, there's a lot of false identities to a comical effect. And it's brilliantly done. The wordplay is fantastic. It's very funny to read.
Yeah.
And someone is mistaken for the word earnest is both a name and an adjective.
Yes.
And that's crucial to mistaken identity into the wordplay in the play.
Definitely. So here's, I guess, one question. How is the person who wrote the ballad? Well, that's not fair because you haven't all read it. So of the sections that, so you all got the.
Give a joke from The Importance of Being Earnest. That's what would be so different.
Say it again.
To lose one parent may be a misfortune. So just think someone's parent has died. And it turns out that actually this person's an orphan and gets criticized. Why? What's the line? To lose one parent may be a misfortune, but to lose both begins to look like carelessness.
Maybe what we should do actually is just start immediately. So you couldn't imagine a more different world, the world of the Ballad of Reading Gaol. You can't imagine a world different than from the world of The Importance of Being Earnest. But it's a topic. Yeah, you are surrounded in the Ballad of Reading Gaol it's as grim and it's kind of coercive. It's as The Importance of Being Earnest isn't. Put it this way: one of the things that Wilde really gives you a sense of is that if you're charming enough, if you're funny enough, if you are witty enough, you can get away with anything. That's a one way of putting what Wilde is up to. If your tongue was golden enough, there's nothing you couldn't do. You could get away with being a more or less sort of open homosexual in late 19th century England, which you couldn't. No matter what class, which you couldn't, no matter what class, that you could get away more or less with anything. Whereas what happens in the Ballad of Reading Gaol, I think, is something very, very different. Here, it seems to me, keeps beat and is in some ways underwrites or is almost like the die, D-Y-E, that demonstrates necessity. Everything that happens in the Ballad of Reading Gaol, starting even with its form, with the ballad form, describes something, fate. Something has come upon the world. The language itself is now simply writing out a death sentence. It's a sentence which is now being written out, rather than something that you are constantly changing through the ability, the agility of your own living tongue. This is a ballad which that's what I think. Billy, do you have anything you want to add here?
I think that's absolutely right, that there's this inevitable thing that's going on. It's strange and interesting that early on in the ballad, if I can dig it up, so if you look at just part one around the fourth stanza. So he's looking, first he sees the man whose name was, the poem is dedicated to the man. Here's a little context for you, which Ricks doesn't give you. It's dedicated to Charles Thomas Woodridge, to CTW.
Yeah.
CTW is the man who has to swing and who does swing. The context is this was, in fact, the first execution done in Reading Jail in 18 years.
Yeah.
And although Wilde doesn't say this, the guards were giddy. It was like, wow, we're doing this amazing thing. We're executing someone, which was part of what was appalling about the whole thing. It's dedicated to him, and it gives the date of his death, which is July 7th, 1896. And the poem is published as being by C.3.3, not by Oscar Wilde, but by C.3.3. which was his jail cell. So later when he talks about his numbered tomb, that was the number of Wilde's tomb. He was C33.
Yeah.
And then a thing to look at, just starting in the fourth stanza, I walked with other souls in pain within another ring and was wondering if the man had done a great or little thing when a voice behind me whispered low, that fellow's got to swing. So what's the illusion there? The souls in pain walking within a ring. Yeah, Red.
Is that a reference to Dante in the rings of hell?
Yes. So here he's in hell. That this is Dante's Inferno. And in hell, there is a ring for homosexuals. And in fact, Dante's teacher is in that ring. Dante essentially thinks it's wrong, that Dante disagrees with God about a lot of things. But the three, just to say it, because I think it's crucial when you have the whole aria about Man Till's the thing he loves. Wilde thought that the person he was killing was his wife and children.
That's right.
He had no regrets about being gay. What he had regrets about was what it did to his wife, who was dying at the time that he was in prison, and to his children, who had to change their names. And he, but his wife loved the poem. She read it before she died, and she loved it. In Dante, there are three, in the nine circles of hell, they are divided into three regions of sinfulness. There are, the first region is the sin, are sins of incontinence. And that's basically when you are a slave to sexual desire, a slave to pleasure in one way or another. The next three circles are sins of violence. And that's when not you're only hurting yourself and sinning against what God wants you to be, but you are hurting other people. And that is, murder is included in among the sins of violence. But the worst thing, the last three circles of hell are the sins of betrayal, so incontinence means you can't stop yourself from doing something you know is wrong. Violence is you can't stop yourself from something you know is wrong, namely violence against others. So it's a particular kind of wrongdoing. But then sins of betrayal are you can't stop yourself from committing violence, but you don't let the other person know what you were doing to them. So they don't have a chance. And Wilde is certainly in the first three circles, but he worries that he might be in the second three also if each man kills the thing he loves. Uh-huh. Douglas asked him what that meant. And Wilde replied to him, you ought to know.
Exactly.
What it means to say each man kills the thing he loves. Yeah. But that's you asked about the total difference between the importance of being earnest and the Ballad of Reading Jail. Well, you know, it's Dante versus a Shakespeare comedy.
Yeah. I think that the other thing, and just take, I have a question for you all. Reading this poem, did you like it, or what did you think? What did you all think about the Ballad of Reading Jail, buddy? Yeah, just anybody. I can't see hands, so maybe Billy.
That's right.
Oh yeah.
You're right. So I also read this poem last semester for my queer poetry course.
Oh yeah.
Something we discussed a lot of times was the vocabulary difference between the people living within the jail and the living jail, where oftentimes the jail is seen as a creature, something that feeds off of the people inside, and it compares with the language of the people inside interacting with the people inside.
That's cool. Yeah.
Is that Morrison's class?
Yes.
Yeah. That was Paul Morrison's class.
Right, exactly. No, that, yeah. Other reactions to the poem or thought you
Aileen, I keep calling you Aileen, but it's Aileen.
It is Aileen.
You should have corrected me.
Pretty much everyone calls me Eileen. I don't even hear it anymore.
All right. Well, good morning, Aileen.
Yes, thank you. I was kind of disturbed by the verse being so sing-songy and so rhythmic and rhyming. It's disturbing when something's supposed to be this depressing and sorrowful, but it takes a nursery rhyme energy.
That's interesting. Yeah. Although, I mean, there's a lot, I mean, there are a fair number of ballad form, Billy, right? Which offer up the same disturbing contrast, yes, or.
So we did Danny Deaver. But it's also, I think, strongly behind this is the Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Totally. Yeah, this is completely the Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
But the Rime of the Ancient Mariner isn't about something that really happened, and this is. So that, in a way, is what makes it so disturbing. I think that goes well with what Red was saying as well. That is that there's this strange language, and maybe the ballad language is, even though it's wild in the first person, it's what a story about ghosts and spirits and the dead forces on you.
Yeah. I think that one of the things that's really important about this language is that it really does. So much of Oscar Wilde. I'm trying to think of like. Let me tell you a story about Oscar Wilde. This is like a classic Wilde story. It's not. It's by no means in the level in the sort of. The grade or the range of Oscar Wilde stories, this is definitely like a B-. It's not that funny a story. There's some really funny things he did. This is not amongst the greatest, but it's not bad. In a sort of undergraduate cool way, not bad. So he was taking his exams and he had to translate a whole bunch of Greek into English. And so what he used was, I don't remember which of the gospels that he had that he was translating in the Greek, and they didn't think he could do it or whatever. And he was there and they gave him a certain number of hours but he wanted to keep going, he says, because he wanted to see how the story came out. So he was going to keep translating, even though he'd already gotten an A, he was going to keep translating because he wanted to see how the story was going to come out. Wilde was someone for whom language was primarily. He wanted to cast the language that he used as the instrument of his, not just of his will, but of his whim. He was do you know people, you must know people like this in your life, who can talk themselves out of anything. You might, your professor here is one such person. I've known Billy. I've known Billy Flesh since 1978, 77, and I'm talking to someone. Actually, I'm going to tell you something real, a real story about Billy Flesh, and then we'll hit Reading Jail, because there's quite related. Billy Flesh, your professor here.
Oh, we seem to have technical difficulties.
Exactly. Back in the day, he had, shall we say, I don't want to say a playful relation to his creditors, but every month he would get a telephone call from the Yale co-op, the debt collection office manned by a single person. I'm not making this up. His name was Mr. Devine. Mr. Devine would call Billy every few weeks to get the money that Billy, Professor Flesh, owed the Yale co-op. And every time, and so at one point, Billy answered the phone. We didn't have caller ID in those days or anything like that. He answered the phone. We only had landlines. We had these things in those days. That's all we had, right? And so he answered the phone, and there was Mr. Devine. Mr. Devine said, I'm calling to speak to Mr. William Flesh. And this is Mr. Devine from the Yale co-op. And Mr. Devine and Billy Flesh said, oh, he's not here right now, Mr. Devine. Can I take a message? At which point Mr. Devine said, you're not fooling me, Mr. Flesh. Please call me back. And he hung up the phone. Did I get that right? Did I miss the story?
I think you got it essentially right.
The point that I'm making here is that Wilde was someone who, Billy.
He compared it to Jonathan Edwards.
I would like to pick up this. There's one line, the picture of Dorian Gray, I can't find it. But there's I should have pulled this up for the class today, Billy. It's a passage where Lord Henry is going on. And I'm going to tell you something else in a second, too. So there's a scene in the picture of Dorian Gray, which is Wilde's, novel, great novel. And he, at one point, Lord Henry, who's this one of the many men in love with Lord with Dorian Gray, Dorian Gray just stipulate, you basically sort of stereotypical Abercrombie. Well, I don't know what you kids know anymore, but just hot Aryan model. Just stipulate hot Aryan model. That's Dorian Gray. So all these men, all these gay men around him are sort of surrounding him, trying to come up with the best speeches to kind of win his attention, to win his favor. So Lord Henry gives a speech, and it's quite a speech. And it's like, and before it, before his charms, logic ran like, a reality ran like frightened forest creatures, that he, the character, Lord Henry, is able to kind of produce it through the confections of his secular sermons, whole visions of new worlds. And there's Dorian Gray completely transfixed by this otherwise not particularly attractive old man. And he's going on and on and on. And there's Dorian Gray completely charmed by this. So that so much of Wilde is about charming, seducing, et cetera, et cetera. But more importantly, not for any obvious sexual end, rather, although that too, that's a different story, but rather for the sake of charming this person, and for, because this charm is somehow the way to basically bring down all the prison walls, is one way to put it. It's a charm which is both the instrument and his words are at once the instrument and the accomplishment of his pure willfulness. You know what? Even though I'm a very, very unattractive old man, through my eloquence, I, taking a page from Socrates, can charm the F out of you. That's what I can do. I can bring down all the differences between us. Just don't listen. Don't look at me. Just listen to the charm of my words. Are you with me so far? That's I think, in essence, what Wilde is about. A lot of what we think of as Wilde. You could write a play which la 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 la. Oh my God! It turns out I was telling the truth all this time. The various kinds of distinctions. The distinction between true and false, between old and young, between et cetera, et cetera. All these things can be brought.
Do you want to describe his essay on lying?
Exactly, of truth, precisely. Well, Billy, why don't you tell them precisely? That's exactly right. And in fact, yeah, actually, that's right. At the level of doctrine, Wilde's primary argument, to the extent that he had an argument, and he did. Billy just talked to you about Matthew Arnold and a bit about Pater. Wilde's great line, and you've already, oh, I see, this was actually sort of a setup, for the power of words per se, of language per se, of what he calls criticism, of artistic representation per se, language, art, etc., per se, the power was to create rather than to simply describe or represent reality. To wit, Billy mentioned to you Arnold's canonical remark, the object of criticism. What is the object of criticism? The object of criticism is to see the object as it is, as it really is, as it really is, right? That's the line. To see the object as it really is, to adequate the object. It is to tell the truth of the object. Wilde's famous line is, what is the object of criticism? To see the object as it really is not, as it is not. In other words, you're creating, you're not, your is the force of the and the force of and the of the is the will is the force of your will which renders which is which, as I say, has its instrument and its accomplishment in your language. Are you with me so far? Does that make sense? It's sort of like, I can get you, every one of you, I can win you. This is what the Wild, whatever, the Lord Henry's, etc. I can win you by means of my charm. I can make new worlds by means of my charm. That's what Wilde's hero is about. In essence, it's this is an old story. This is a very old story, right? It's why Plato exiled the poets from the Republic. It's an old story, and it's a story that Wilde adores. Notice how different the Ballad of Reading Gaol is. Notice how different the Ballad of Lady Dale is. This is not that story now. This is now the story of a man who, this is the story, even the form, it's not his form, right? This is the ballad form. He is now the anonymous, the more or less anonymous conveyor of language. He's no longer, this is no longer his language. The language, as it were, operates through him. Billy, do you think I'm wrong?
Well, I know, Jeff. No, I think that's absolutely right. That is that one thing that you could say, if you say that all art is perfectly useless, one thing that you're saying, and maybe this, I hadn't put it together this way before, but maybe this is thing to say about charm, is that charm is always self-reflective. That is to say, it's not simply that he's charming, but that what's charming about him is that he is making you love his charm. So Jeff and I used to play this game called Make Me Like Him. Remember that game, Jeff?
I remember it vividly. Yes.
Yeah. So it's a useful game. We'd see the kind of person you see on the street who you immediately have their whole personality in your mind, which is that they're a selfish jerk, crabby, cranky, selfish jerk. Jeff and I would walk down the street, and Jeff would then say, "Make me like him," and then I'd have to come up with some kind of story where we were misreading him terribly, and there was. Depth and sorrow and so on. But charm is more like, let me make you like me, despite the fact that in general, you're the kind of person who rightly doesn't like people who try to make you like them. But you can like the fact that I know that. And I want you to like the fact that I'm different from all these other people who say, who try to make you like them, without the kind of self-awareness and the sense that there's something which is a little bit too easy about that. But what I'm going to do now is make that itself an invitation into a kind of pleasure. So when Jeff said, "Make me like him," what Jeff was inviting me to was a pleasurable narrative. Like, look at this person and come up with and have the pleasure of narrating something about them that that you're making up, and that I know that you're making up, and that it would be fun to hear you make up.
Yep.
And then what he's basically saying is, it would be really fun for you if you liked me. And the reason it would be fun for you if you liked me is because I'm the person. So it would be fun for you that finding yourself liking someone because they think it would be fun for you to like them. That's a fun thing for me to say. Yeah. So that's how, in a sense, how all art is perfectly useless, because it's about itself, and it's about essentially saying, just find a reason to enjoy this. And what you should enjoy is that you are being invited to enjoy it. I think that's a version of what you're, a less eloquent version of what you're saying about.
No, that's a much better version.
It's less good, but.
Not at all. It's much better. But just compare that
to
Dick, this whole atmosphere we're talking about, to the lines that that start after where Billy stopped reading. The next stanza: "Dear Christ, the very prison walls suddenly seemed to reel, and the sky above my head became like a cask of scorching steel. And though I was a soul in pain, my pain I could not feel." First of all, just that phrase, "and though I was a soul in pain, my pain I could not feel." So where is his pain? If he cannot feel it, what is, I guess what I'm asking is, what is the nature of pain that you cannot feel? "And though I was a soul in pain, my pain I could not feel." Is it pain? If you said, I'm asking, it's a real question. I swear to God, it's related to what we're talking about. Is it a real pain if you can't feel it? I can't. Is there somebody raising their hand? I can't see. Anyone could just say anything if there's. Because.
It's a real question.
I
don't know. It makes me think of almost a level of like numbness. Like there is maybe like a real sense of harm that initially it did hurt, and now it's just been so constant that you're no longer really perceptive to it, even though you're aware that it's still happening.
That's totally great, actually. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I've seen, oh, there you are. Okay. So, right. Okay, wait. Okay, yeah. So, sorry. Yeah, I think that's the numb thing is good. I think that's right. I want to make an obvious point here, just for starters, though, and that is, that's actually right. I think it's totally right. Who just said that? Sorry, I can't.
That was Julia.
No, you're okay.
Hello. Anyway, so, yeah. Did you want to say something more? Because yeah, that I totally
that's
there.
What I got.
Yeah, you got a lot. That's a lot. That's good. Okay, I'm just going to say that notion of a pain, which has now become, you know, a formal feeling, comes, is now a sort of blankness or whatever. That's there. But certainly with the line, and certainly what the line insists on is that you could have pain and you don't have access to. Right? My pain, I could not feel. I don't feel my pain, but I know I have pain, right? That's makes me think of a great line in a really famous, quite gorgeous line in Hard Times, Dickens's Hard Times, where the mom is dying. Mrs. Gradgrind is up and dying, and her daughter says to her, "Mom, are you in pain? Are you in pain?" And the mother says, "I know that there is pain in this room, but I cannot say where it is exactly."
Doesn't Fanny keep asking, "Who is this in pain?" In our mutual friend,
"Who is this in pain? Who is this in pain? My pain, I could not feel." So, I mean, however you want to cut it, you can put it either in Julia's terms, you could put it in Freudian terms, that one would have inaccessible pain. It is quite unlike Wilde's general view of his happier view, his unimprisoned view of basically anything, which is that if you're not conscious of it, pain, etc., love, whatever, it doesn't exist. Since really the radical Wilde, the Wilde of the importance of being earnest, for example, is the Wilde who says, I feel what it is that I can successfully manufacture. That is what I feel. What I successfully manufacture, I will feel. So if I write love letters to nobody that I haven't met yet, but I'm feeling all this love, eventually that love will be enshrined in an object. In other words, I produce my feelings in my diary. I write these diaries. They're full of all kinds of emotion. This girl says it's a perfectly good diary, and it's all made up. It's fiction. My emotions are whatever it is. I worked in the Senate very briefly, there was one senator, a very, very senior senator, the least gay, least Oscar Wildean person I'd ever seen in real life, who said one of the most Wildean things I'd ever heard in my life, which was people were saying, "Senator Magnuson, we've got to give more money to raise sort of welfare benefits because of the recession." And he said, "Oh, you talk yourself into a recession, you can talk yourself out of a recession." But there's something like that goes on with Wilde, except not here, not in prison. Suddenly now he's surrounded and haunted by objects and emotions which he cannot control, which sometimes he cannot even feel. My pain, I could not feel. In that sense, that the pain is so great, it presses so greatly that sometimes I do not even feel it. That's new for Wilde. That's new for Wilde. This is a new Oscar Wilde. The one that we, so there's that. Let's go on a little bit further, I think.
Well, so isn't it that it's also, I mean, so I think what you're saying is in a sense, this is the converse of taking pleasure, and taking pleasure is feeling the pain of not being able to feel pain. And I think, isn't it partly, if you go to line 91, where he says, well, maybe let's start at the stanza before that. So Wooldridge is sleeping well the night before he's going to die.
Yeah.
Which he's amazed by. And he says, "But there is no sleep when men must weep who never yet have wept." And that means him and the other prisoners who don't have to swing. So we, the fool, the fraud, the knave, that endless vigil kept, and through each brain on hands of pain, another's terror crept. So that's a pretty amazing phrase, on hands of pain.
Billy, what line is this, Billy?
Right, so this is, at least the way Rick's lineates it, it's part three, line 90 or so. But if you have the scan that I sent you, it's page 551. So through each brain on hands of pain, another's terror crept. So whose pain is that? Is it the pain? So the terror is feeling pain. It's creeping on its own hands. It's crawling with its hands on the ground. But the hands of pain, are those the hands of the terror feeling pain? Or is it the pain of the man who's sleeping sweetly, even though he's going to die at 8 a.m.? Or is it the pain of those through whose brain the terror creeps? And then he goes on. Alas, it is a fearful, I just want to say, the fool, the fraud, the knave, those are the three kinds of people who are in prison.
Yeah.
Those are the Dantesque, that's the Dantesque triad. So the fool is the lover, the fraud is the worst, the knave is the figure of violence.
Yeah.
But the fool means him. That is the person who's in Reading jail for being gay.
Yeah.
And then he goes on, alas, it is a fearful thing to feel another's guilt.
Yeah.
The tears that we shed was for blood we had not spilt. So what's happened there is that I think that's the pendant to, and though I was a soul in pain, my pain I could not feel. It could partly be my pain I could not feel, but it's also the pain of knowing that there is this other pain, which is much worse than his, the pain of the person who is about to be executed.
Oh, Billy, you're so good. So kids, I have a question for you. really good, Billy. That was great. Okay, kids, I have a question for you. Do you like being back in class? I swear to God, this is related. This is not just an idle question. Or to put it differently, what was the best part of the pandemic? Were there any good things about the pandy for you all? And that sounds irrelevant, but I swear to God, this is totally pertinent. And Billy, you'll have to call on people because my eyes, I can't see people's hands. And I'm really sorry I'm not there, you all.
All right.
I'm not there.
And then, right.
I really would have been there. Yeah.
Back in class, and I found very little optimistic about the pandemic.
Okay, so Quinn says she prefers being back in class and found very little optimistic about the pandemic. And right?
I so prefer being back on campus than being at home, but I enjoyed spending more time with my animals.
Oh, that's so cool. Oh my God, and you're reminding me, this is totally relevant too, of one of the great lines that Billy memorized, recited to me when we were very young kids, which was, I would go out and live amongst the animals. They are so placid and self-contained. They do not prate to me of my duty to God and my duty to man. Am I getting that right, Billy?
Yeah, that's Walt.
Yeah, I mentioned that because I want to suggest something here about Wild and about all of us. And basically, it's about congestion. It's about when we're all together. So I'm going to remind you or tell you a great line of Oscar Wilde's. Oscar Wilde wrote a really, really brilliant pay on the socialism. It's called The Soul of Man Under Socialism. And it's the most Ayn Randian socialism you've ever heard. The first sentence of a socialist treatise is, the reason why we got to have socialism is that way the sordid necessity of living for others will finally be brought to an end and I could just really devote myself to myself. That's what Wilde says. Much more time for moi-même if we finally take care of the poor. I don't have to like be so upset about it all the time. It won't be harshing on my buzz as an individual. Are you with me so far? We've got to have better taxes, more progressive taxation, because I'm sick of worrying about the poor and I'm just throwing up in my mouth every time I see them and I can't devote myself to myself, which is my real goal in life. That's Wild socialism. Are you with me so far? I think it's a very realistic socialism, right? It's a very real, it's a selfish socialism. And why am I talking about that here? Because I think what's really amazing about this poem is that, and I don't like it. I don't like this poem. I don't know if you all like it. I don't like this poem at all. But I think what's amazing about it this supreme individualist, Oscar Wilde, this great poet of individual, Oscar Wilde, is suddenly in a place where he can't tell his feelings apart from other people's. And that's different. You know that feeling that you get sometimes if you go to a class and you're in sort of a bummer mood and you're thinking, I'm getting infected by other people's bad headspace. There's a kind of psychological toxin and I'm getting polluted by other people's minds. You know what I mean? Like certain kinds of colleagues, certain kinds of people, certain kinds, I guess the word that was toxic, but I don't even, you don't have to get that high and mighty. I don't mean like toxic. I mean like, you know, just like somebody who's a bummer. I don't want to be around that person. She always tarshes on my buzz. Are you with me? Does that make sense what I'm talking about? And so Wilde, who's so much about, and you know people like this, you're looking at someone like this, but you know people like this, maybe you're a little bit like this yourself, where basically you're just so damn, you're just such a sort of a mood Nazi about your own moods. I want to make sure I feel good, you know what I mean? And I don't want to be brought down. That was Wilde. That was really wild. He's just gonna, everything, why did everything have to be beautiful around him? It had to be beautiful in order for, including people, his great line, I choose my friends for their intellect, excuse me, I choose my enemies for their intellect and my friends for their beauty. And because he's gotta be around beautiful people, intellectuals, whatever, but for his own headspace. And then compared that to what happened to him in this prison. I can't feel my own feelings, my own pain, but look what he can feel that Billy with his usual acumen draws us to. Let's look again at these lines. But there is no sleep when men must weep, who never wept. So we, the fool, the fraud, the knave, that endless vigil kept, and through each brain on hands of pain, another terror's crept. Bad enough to have your own terror. How much worse when you have to have everyone else's terror too. And you all know this, if you say were raised in an unhappy house in any way, and suddenly your sibling's pain had to be your pain, right? You couldn't really tell it apart. Or when your mom was in a really sad, frightened mood, suddenly that mood infects you. You can't really tell the difference, right? Another's terrors crept. The look in the eyes, you know, people wonder how historical trauma is passed from generation to generation. And a friend said to me, just look at her eyes. She's got Holocaust eyes. She's got Holocaust eyes. This friend said to me about a girl who did in fact have Holocaust eyes. We all know this, how other terrors creep into our lives. So antithetical to the great Oscar Wilde. So antithetical. The food sucked at prison, but that was not the worst of it. Not by any means. The worst of it was how terrors could not be kept apart. Alas, it is a fearful thing to feel another's guilt. For right within, the sword of sin pierced to its poisoned hilt, and as molten lead with the tears we shed for the blood we had not spilt. The sordid necessity of living for others. And thank God that what Wilde gets out of this, at least in a way, is something like what we call fellow feeling. Not that he lacked it before, but there's a whole new Wilde who comes out of prison. And it's one of the great tragedies, not just of English letters, but of English history, that Wilde couldn't have lived longer after this time and written as it were for real, because he never wrote again. He never wrote again. He wrote a letter, but he wrote that in prison. He wrote that in prison. He never seriously wrote again. And it's just too bad, because I think Wilde's incredible gift could have been so well served by this time in prison, because he's experiencing something here that he's defined himself as aloof from before. And it's precisely that sense of distance of separateness between the new individualism, as he called it, in the sense that there are moments where what defines us is not the specificity of our own emotions and in our own thoughts, but rather just the opposite. Wilde was one of the great individualists brought down by this pain. Billy, is there anything else you want to add to this, or even to disagree with it totally?
Sorry.
No, no,
just jump in.
No, please do shout over me anytime. Sorry. Shit.
I was thinking about this throughout the class and also over the weekend. You and I were talking a little bit more about the Wildean idea of like art being beautifully useless. And I think it's there's a question somewhere in this, but I'm kind of just commenting on like, I love the idea that art is a beautifully useless endeavor because it relieves so much pressure and also so much like a Victorian idea that art has to be serious.
Yeah.
But that being said, like a lot of what has been brought up in class has been about Wilde being such a beautiful writer and such a prolific one. And I guess like what I want to comment on is like, how does one deal with the juxtaposition of the art being useless and him being a kind of frivolous person, but also deep down knowing that craft is a really serious business because it's hard, and writing and like drafting and asking people about your art. Like, I guess there's a question in there somewhere, but like what was there to do about the fact that somewhere he must have known that he was working very hard, even if he didn't want to admit it?
I think that's a really, really good question. And I think that, I think it's as much of anything else as an observation. I don't think that Wilde. Let me just say this. I actually think what you're saying is helpful. It helps me a lot, and I'll tell you why. It helps me understand something about Wilde. I really appreciate this, which is that Wilde really did. He lived a version sprezzatura of the kind of work that the courtier does, that a person in a court does, that a person in a king's court, a royal court, a certain kind of heavily pressurized socializing, where the most important part of what you're doing, of your work, is to pretend that it's not work, right? Look, Ma, no hands. To look how easy it seems, right? You make it seem so easy. That is not only the most important compliment that you offer up to the courtier and a certain kind of artist and to the Oscar Wilde type. It is a compliment that should never have to be made, because of course it looks easy, right? So I think you're dead right about this. And there's some way in which you could say, I don't exactly say that yet, but one might be tempted to say that Wilde's tone here is more sincere, to use a very un-Wildean word, right? That Wilde actually, I'll tell you a story about Wilde, actually. I haven't thought about this for years. And I really, was that Julie who just said that?
Quinn.
I mean, all of your comments are something. It's a story I haven't thought about for years. Oscar Wilde, after he was released from prison, he was constantly in and out of the doghouse with his estranged wife, who held the purse strings in his life, what money he had. So he was constantly, and she was, you know, he was, the rule was, it's fine as long as you don't go back to Alfred Douglas. And he couldn't resist. They had that kind of relationship. To call it love would be a little bit romanticizing, but it was certainly a compulsion. I guess it was love. It's stupid of me. That was even, you know, internalized homophobia. It was definitely love. In any case, but he never had money. He was constantly having to basically beg money from old friends. So he writes this, a big opera singer named, I can't remember her name, Melba something or that. Oh, you would know her, late, Billy. Melba, she was the origin of Melba Toast. I can't remember her name now. Lady Melba. So he asks her for money, and she writes back this incredibly nasty, because super ornate, over the top response, very kind of literary and witty, basically saying no. And Lord Henry, excuse me, and Wilde's response to her was, my dear Madam So-and-so, such a sentiment need not be put up on stilts. Need not be put up on stilts, right? I think what we have with Wilde is some sense here that he doesn't want his, he's going to go with the sort of the form of the, the writing isn't going to do anything more than the writing must do. That's, I don't think that's exactly true, but that's, I think, in some sense, what we have here with this poem, a sense that he's going to minimize the stilting, that there's a lot of things that he's no longer interested in artifice per se. I guess that's one way of putting it. Now, what I'm saying is a little bit simple-minded, but I still think there's something to it. And the other thing I was just going to add about this is that I think that Wilde has a really hard time with the idea of confession. This poem is a much more successful version of confession than he has. He has a letter, which was ultimately, I think, very self-serving, called that came to be called De Profundis, his letter to his boyfriend. But I think that what goes on here is just, I do think that there's this way that he is kind of admitting something. One is that this isn't easy. That it isn't easy, and it's not easy for various reasons, that writing isn't easy, that it's driven by compulsions, or it's only driven by certain compulsions, and the writing here is especially uneasy. Something else I want to notice here, and that is the name of the writer. The author, who is the author of the poem? CC, what is it? CC33, right?
Yeah.
So he calls himself a couple of other things, publications, because of course he can't publish under his name anymore, right? To publish under Oscar Wilde at this point would be like publishing under, you know, some neo-Nazi. I mean, it was no longer, he was de trop. You couldn't say, the name couldn't be said. But there seems something also, to my mind at least, also CC33, the Christological age, as we, you know, the age that Christ was when he was, as it were, assassinated, crucified, right? That's there, and that's deliberately there. So it just so happens that the prison was also the age that Christ was crucified at. But just the way that the writing, you could almost feel a kind of a drifting or into kind of anonymity, that the author of this poem never has Oscar Wilde, it seems to me, done more to efface himself than he has in this poem. This is as close as you get to anonymous. The ballad form, who is the author of a ballad? Precisely, no one. That is to say, tradition, right? This is a very different Wilde. This is about as far away from the Wilde of The Importance of Being Earnest or The Soul of Mandarin Socialism, which is all about, hey, I gotta be me, and you're gonna love me for me. The egotistical sublime, to coin a phrase. Yeah, so that's just, right?
Was it important to Wilde that he was well-known and popular for his writing?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so, when he came to the U.S., here, we can do this. Have you anything to declare, Mr. Wilde?
Nothing but my genius. I have nothing to declare but my genius. Yeah. He was, you know who he was, you all? He was the guy who just got away with everything because he was so charming. Not even cute, just charming, hilarious, as funny. You know those people, you know, we all have these people in our life, right? Who you just think to yourself, oh my God, he's such a pain in the ass. He's such a dick in so many ways. But I can't help but love him. He's just so funny. He's just so charming. That was Wilde. And the business about, and a lot got hidden under this personality, this scamp, this reprobate, as Harold Bloom once called Billy, you sir, a reprobate. But where the words reprobate, scamp are laureled in love, right? It's really just another way of saying, I love you, right? You're such a pain in the ass, but we all have people like boyfriends, girlfriends, siblings, maybe parents, although that's a different story, friends, etc., students. And we think, as one friend said to me about a kid decades ago, this friend, and he was straight, this friend, about this really cute guy, super cute guy. And this friend of mine said, a colleague said, when it comes to so-and-so, I forgive him everything in advance. And there's something about Wilde, the world that Wilde lives in is a world where he's forgiven everything in advance. And moreover, where he forgives everything in advance. He was a super generous guy. He was, as Alfred Douglas said at the end of his life, somebody, George Bernard Shaw, who was a friend of the boyfriend's, said that very late in his life, the only thing that Alfred Douglas would say about him was, and I quote, he was the kindest of men. He was the kindest of men. And he was a really kind guy, and he was more, he was somebody, that was just his image in the world. So that the end of, for example, this is the way that he conducted himself in the world, both as someone who was going to receive that scamp, the son, oh my God, I'm losing my mind. You know, Billy, you know, the son who comes back, the bad son who comes back, you know who I mean.
Oh, the prodigal son.
Prodigal, yeah. The prodigal son. He was the prodigal son, and suddenly now he's in prison. There's a really quite magisterial biography of him by Elman. The last paragraph just take this in. This is such a different Wilde. Just listen to this. This is Elman. Again, you know. This super heavy biographer, but he writes the following lines at the end. And so in the end, there is Oscar Wilde. He says, he stands before us, untouched now by all the scandals that brought him down. He stands before us, a colossus still, a giant still, laughing and weeping with his parables and his paradoxes approaching us, so generous, so amusing, and so right. What do I mean by right? And there's a footnote to the last line, so right, and it's a reference to a gorgeous essay by the great Argentine writer Borges. And Borges adored Oscar Wilde, and he wrote an essay about Oscar Wilde, which ends with the following sentence. Oscar Wilde was always right. Now, whether or not Oscar was in fact always right, he conducted himself as someone who was always right. He was sort of like his own ambassador, and he conducted himself. He was that sort of person who would go into a restaurant or go into a party, and suddenly the whole place was he'd get them basically to kind of cater to him and to surround him, and because he was always right to that extent. What he said was very witty, was very generous, and he was always right. And he conducted himself with a kind of self-confidence that would get that. Suddenly now we have a very different language. We have the language of a ballad. And it's a language about, even though it could be about him, it's not. It's about this other person who's killed his wife, right? Let's look at a couple more stanzas right after the ones that Billy, for the blood we had. Oh, wait, where are you? You disappeared. Sorry. Oh, there you are. Billy, what time does this class go till?
Till 3:50.
Okay.
So we have another 17 minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry, you all. I haven't let you all talk. So can someone, I'm sorry. Can someone just read the stanza that starts with all the warders with their shoes?
Oh, please. Sorry, this comment. Irina.
And I don't want to dwell on this because we've been past. If we just go back to the, my pain I could not feel for a second. Wilde is somebody that's like, I also don't want to get too into like, psychology of being in a prison, but if he's somebody that's concerned with his individuality,
yes,
and he's just earlier acknowledged that like he's a soul with other souls in pain,
yeah,
could this line where he says he distinguishes that he doesn't want to feel his pain or he's no longer going to feel his pain could be like an attempt at self-preservation but also distinction such that he can still retain these elements here? I think similarly, because I was just scanning this poem really quickly, there's very few instances where, like you said, like he's speaking about himself, but then also in the second last line, none knew so well as I, for he who lives more lives than one, more deaths than one must die. We've already heard those couple lines repeated several times, but since he's adding like his own case or his own involvement in that, being that he's claiming to know this concept better than the other prison mates that he's with, that he's previously like grouped in. Could this also be seen as like, as I said, like an attempt at self-preservation to retain that old version of Wilde?
You know, I have to tell you something. I am so grateful to you. That is such a good observation. I think that's exactly right. I had not thought of that. And I want to start with the first thing that you said. And though I was a soul in pain, my pain I could not feel, I really take your point. And one way of sort of describing what I think you're getting at, or putting what I think you're getting at is, here he's saying, so the fact that he can't feel his pain is less important in this context than the fact that he's asserting his own pain. There is a pain here. It's my pain. My pain I could not feel. And though I was a soul in pain, my pain I could not feel. So I think that it goes both ways in a sense, because to go back to my argument, my pain I could not feel. So I feel other people's pain, and my own pain I cannot feel. So the confusion continues. But your point, my friend, is supreme, and that is. And that is superseding, and that is that he's, or at least is important, and that is he's just, and I like the way you put it, self-preservation, because I think it's right. I think it's self-preservation in a double sense, and one because of the second. Self-preservation in the sense of I am sustaining my specificity, I'm preserving this concept of the self. I have pain, but self-preservation in a more, as it were, as the kids say, basic sense, which is to say, I'm just staying alive. Right. I think both things are true. And I think that's very good. That's a very smart comment. Much smarter than anything I've said to you. But I want to ask you, because I'm not sure I fully understood what you were saying about the other stanza, which was the man he had killed the thing. So where are you saying that I have that he, Wilde, is asserting a particular? Oh, I only knew. So it's the first word. I only knew what. I'm sorry, my eyes are.
I was looking at the stanza starts. And all the woe that moved him so. But then four lines down, it says, none knew so well as I.
Where is that? I love
it. I think it's the end
I really want to find it.
Third section.
Yeah, it's towards the end of part three.
Okay.
If you look at the scan, it's the very last thing.
Okay. Okay. So it's page 553, Billy?
554.
I didn't get. Okay. Which I didn't. Oh, wait. Did I print it down? 554. Sorry, you all. I can't find 554. Isn't that weird? Oh, here it is. I found it. Sorry. Okay. Sorry. So 554.
Last stanza.
I don't have it. Sorry. I thought it was. I'm sorry, you all. I don't seem to have that page. I thought I did. But I have it.
Are you sure?
Yeah, could you just for a second? Because I really like that comment. I just want to, I don't know why I don't have that. Maybe I ran out of Petra. No. Oh, wait, 553 is where I stopped. I don't know what happened. Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry, Bill. Did I run out of, maybe. Oh, wait, you know what? I just run out of paper in my paper. Sorry.
You could just type in chat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Jeff, do you want me to type it in the chat?
Thank you. Okay, it's coming now. It's coming. Here it is. Okay. Here we are, fresh off the printer. Okay, now let's get to where you were. Stanza which begins.
It's the last stanza on page 554.
Got it. Okay, so, and all the woe that moved him so that he gave, and all the woe that moved him so that gave, that he gave a bitter, that bitter cry, and the wild regrets and the bloody sweats. None knew as got you as well as I, for he who lives more lives than one. Wow. There's your point right there. Yeah. There's your point. There he is. For he who lives more lives than one. So it's interesting here that, and this is very wild. Thank you for showing me this, because it just goes to show, once an egotist, always an egotist. Because now what he's saying, I think you're totally right. What he's saying here, which is so cool, is what makes me distinctive? That I am so indistinctive, that I have so many lives, right? It's a little bit like Oprah and Ghost. Remember, she suddenly becomes like a real conveyor of all those, whatever. So here he is. What makes him special? That he's so unspecial, right? that he's, I think you're so right. And you know what? You're making me feel opposite of depressed because I suddenly think if while we're in the Cultural Revolution or some such shit, whatever the Maoism is of the moment, that he would, you could just see if he had to have his own little, he'd still have his own little space in the communal garden, which would be somehow special, that somehow he would still be special. And that is, so I really, it gives me all those goosebumps to think about this line in this context. I really mean it because damn, here's Wilde and he's still singing his song, by which I mean what makes me special song. Do you know what I mean? I think you're right, right here. I really love it. And I had not thought of that. I've not. I mean,
Jeffrey,
I mean, yeah. Yeah. Leon. So,
okay. So I did have a point, but since the last one just made you so happy, I'm afraid
my friend all makes me so happy.
Of these lines to make you sad again. happens. I'm sorry. You're the best.
Make it odd, buddy. I love it.
Yeah, because the way I look at this poem is kind of about, you know, how all the wildism kind of stops working in this case. Wilde believes in individuality, and he also believes in, let's say, the special position of, let's say, the poet or the artist in
this
poetic world. So he once said, you know, a man is leaves himself when he is himself. It's the mask that keeps him talking.
Right, right.
True. But in this poem, I feel like, you know, it's no longer as in his older works, like his art, his wit, it can solidify his position as an outsider narrating all this. It's like the disappearance of the mask. So he's talking about, okay, we're all living together and, you know, I can write and write and write about all these ways some people kill their love. You know, some kill this way, some kill that way, some for this reason, some for that reason. But eventually we all are going to end up in the same place and doing the same thing. And eventually we are really no different. Like, you know, the it's kind of like the individuality just kind of stops appearing in, you know, we are not that different in the face of our shared vulnerability in front of our guilt and our past. And of course, our inevitable demise. So in the end, I feel the way I read the last lines, no one knew so well as I, for he who lives more lives than one, more deaths than one must die. It's one of the idea when there's all this collectivism thing kind of just forms, like, okay, we are all living this the same life. And as long as it goes on, the same kind of tragedy, the same death is going to keep repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat. So it's kind of goes, it's kind of like a denial of everything he used to believe in. So now the I, who cannot feel his own pain, my pain I could not feel because it's now a shared pain now. So that's at least how I see the line. I don't know what you think about.
I love what you just said. And I don't think that it, I mean, it contradicts, but I think both things are true. I think both things are true. I think you're quite right. This is a grim poem. And I'm put in mind, I have a lot of thought. I have several thoughts about why this poem has been, I think, understudied. It's a Wilde piece, which has been, I think, Wilde did not write all that much. Wilde is someone who, to be a scholar of Wilde is not nearly as impressive as being a scholar of, Wordsworth or of Tennyson. Well, Tennyson maybe. Certainly. Dickens, exactly. Because he didn't write all that much. He actually didn't. It can be sort of contained. And I think that you can read it all. And I think though that what's certainly true is that this poem of all his, I think is understudied, partly because it's depressing, I think, partly because I think it, that's hardly the only reason, partly I think because it's so it's so hard to not see it as just this description, this admission, this confession of despair. As one of one critic says, not a great critic of Wilde, but a brilliant critic named D.A. Miller says that by the time we get to this poem, that all Wilde can do is to read the conditions of his imprisonment. That all Wilde can do is to understand the conditions of his own imprisonment, of the loss of that kind of free self That's what's going on here. And I think that that's true, except where it's not, and in ways which it is not. And it may be that those ways, which I think your two comments, your comment and your colleague's comment, when taken together, give us a pretty good sense of what Wilde accomplishes in this strange and depressing poem, which is a kind of a constitution or an admission of how much he has lost, of how stripped he is, of how stripped any self is, and certainly the self, which is the gorgeous sort of collection of feints and masks, which was Oscar Wilde, in control, right? That, but at the same time, yes, that's all true, but you get these little moments. Which, tell me your name again, your name, that you with this, who made all the comments before. Yeah. Yeah, you. No, I'm right next to
you. Which one?
Which one of us? Who's sitting right next to you? Yeah. Arena? Is it Arena?
Jesus, getting everyone's name wrong.
I'm sorry, Rena and
I know.
And the young
man. No, it's
Irina, and then the young man.
Irina. Okay.
Yeah. Irina and the young man who made, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, taken together, all of these comments constitute, I think, a recognition of what this poem accomplishes. And that is, it is a falling away from Wilde's, the persona of Wilde that is most terrifically and kind of famously and memorably and constituted in characters like Lord Henry, or like the speakers who are just so full of themselves in a good way, but still you have what constitutes, I would say, something analogous almost to graffiti in a prison. This where he still slips in a little bit of the old egotism, right? He still slips in just a little bit of it in the. But I, who know more, who knew so well, none knew so well as I, for he who lives, the world, da, 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 none knew well so well as I. So still, paradoxically, even in the annulment of myself, even in the fact that I've lived all these other whatever, not just my own, even in the face of such weak boundaries of the ego now, even there, in the extent of that failure of boundaries, I'm special. I still think there's something there, and I don't take this to be trivial. That sense of preserving the language, preserving the self, that sense of saving some part of the self. I think that as much as the very real compassion the poem has for someone other than himself, the preservation of the self there too, I think, is a tremendous act of humanitas in this poem. That's what I think. Yeah. And this is not a poem, by the way, just so you know, I don't like this poem, and I wasn't even really jazzed about discussing it, but now I'm really because of you all, the outcome of you and Oscar Wilde. Yeah. Questions or comments?
So why don't you like the poem?
Yeah, so why don't you like the poem?
You know, actually, that's not fair. I do like it. It's just that, I think it's just my issue with, frankly, for some of the reasons that the young man with interesting accent, what's your name again, young man?
Leon.
You.
Yeah.
Where are you from, if I might ask?
Shanghai, China.
Okay. That Leon's, for much of the reasons that Leon has set out here, it's just, to my mind, such a falling away from the Wilde whom I know and love. And one of the reasons why I'm so sorry that he didn't live longer in a healthier way, is that I'd like to have had the person who had this experience write more, and write more like the Wilde of old. This is Wilde in extremis. He wrote this right after prison, partly in prison. This is Wilde in extremis. And I'd like to see Wilde, knowing these things, this deep pain, which has humanized his soul, to quote Wordsworth, writing more. So there's that. The afterlife of this poem is astonishing, as Professor Flesh or Billy, or however you'll go by, Professor Flesh, will tell you, his appearance in Corel, its appearance in film, that each man kills the thing he loves. That line is so important. And by the way, yeah, okay, I see we're out of time. Wait, what time is it? Yeah. Other thoughts or feelings that you have?
Well, thank you. We have just enough time to thank you. So.
Thank you. I'm sorry that I wasn't better together, you all. I really love this class, and I've been watching it. I'm a big fan, big fan. So I'll see you again, I hope. Yeah. And yeah.
Okay.
So thanks a lot, you all. Yeah. Are we leaving?
Thank
okay.
You.
Thank you. Thanks, you guys.
Bye-bye.
Okay.